The following program is a CLW83.com production. This edition of the NAWC is
uncensored.
Oh, watch out! Oh, my God! Wow. What the hell is that?
What's that?
What the hell? Who is that?
Wait a minute.
What the hell was that? Oh! It's Edge! That's the number one contender for the Cena's. Wait a minute, Edge!
Edge spearing the WWE Champion John Cena through the table.
Where the hell did he come from? Speechless. Come on, Rob. Go for the kill.
Capitalize. We'll take it.
Go, Rob.
Don't be proud, Rob. Go for it.
Do it. There's no ref, though.
Van Dam up top.
We need a ref out of go.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special edition of the North American Wrestling Connection. My name is Nikki Heyman, and I have procured the interview of interviews, a gentleman who has revolutionized part of the wrestling industry today and is enjoying his happy retirement in Hollywood. So I have with me today Jim Williams, but our guest today is none other than Mr. Pay-Per-View, Mr. Monday Night, Mr. Hollywood, and the only man on the planet that will not get mad at anything. Ladies and gentlemen, Rob Van Dam.
Greetings, Nikki Heyman, master leader of Team Extreme.
I am so glad you had found some time to come sit with us for a little bit. What have you been up to?
Dude, was that me that you were announcing as being in retirement, by the way?
Am I incorrect about that? I know you don't wrestle as often.
Right. Yeah. So that would be incorrect, but whatever. You know how I am. I don't really fit labels anyway. So I'm just kind of like doing my thing. I have an open door with WWE to go back when I'm ready to go back. And then on top of that, they were so good to me last time in 2014 as far as working around what I wanted to do. They actually let me pick my own dates. Like, we decided, okay, we'll start here and we'll end here. There's 5 months. We got like 4 pay-per-views, boom, 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 boom. I actually got to circle like all of the shows that I wanted to go to. And doesn't mean 100% that they won't say, well, hey, look, you know, can we swap that out? We really need you at this one. But they've been really good working with me. When I left WWE in 2006, it was because I was so burnt out. I could not stand being on the road. I hated my life. Hate's a strong word, but I'm just saying that so you people can relate to it. I was very, 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 very frustrated, burnt out. And I said I could not imagine I would go back to WWE under the same conditions. I came back 2013 with now a short-run deal. That's awesome. That's never been available before. But Chris Jericho precedented this schedule working around his band, Fozzy. And so Hunter said, look, we could try that with you. You know, we could come and go, you know. And so that's what it was. It was a 90-day deal, and I had 66 matches in 90 days, plus all the travel time. You can imagine I wasn't home. The other guys, that's what they do every 90 days. So for me, it was perfect that I got to leave. And, you know, I went back in 2014. 2015, have not been ready to go back. And I'm still not ready to go back. But I have the open door. I'm also under contract with them as far as we have a merchandise deal, which does also cover my intellectual property, RVD's image, which does affect me taking wrestling bookings for other companies that would be considered competition by someone with a, you know, strong imagination. So anyway, that's my situation as of now. So I'm taking like a few selective wrestling bookings in between, which I didn't think I would do when I left WWE last time. I thought I'm probably not going to take any bookings, or maybe one or two in Amsterdam or something cool like that, maybe. But I have taken more than I thought I would, and it's just because the business has been good on it. I can pick and choose. And if I want to go somewhere really cool, like New York City, that has a big value in it. I've probably had like about six matches this year instead of six matches every week. I've also done two movies this year, plus some other movie projects that I'm not talking about yet that I'm on the production end of putting together. And so that's been cool. And basically, I'm enjoying not traveling all the time. I'm enjoying being in California, and I basically get filter through opportunities that come my way and give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down. And it's cool when you're RVD. Like people pay you just to be RVD. Sometimes it's wrestling. Sometimes it's just signing autographs, taking pictures. Sometimes it's stand-up comedy. Sometimes it's acting. Whatever, when it comes to enjoying the business end of it, that stuff's all like really cool. And then I have some writing projects that are more passion than business until they become business. But I keep busy, and I watch a lot of TV in between all that.
So you're still active in watching the product.
Well, I watch product as far as like Hollywood products and stuff like that. I don't watch wrestling, but I really haven't and never did for most of my career. That's one thing that fans are going to hate on, and I don't blame them. When I was a fan, I hated to hear that a wrestler didn't, you know, how could you not want to watch that, man? I'm not looking for advice on how I can improve my career after 26 years and being the whole effing show. So
there it is. But,
so when I was with WWE, the first run, 2001 to 2006, I would record the show and I would fast forward and just watch my match for just to criticize it, you know, to, hey, you know what, that move sucks, I got to quit doing that, or I got to get up faster here, or, you know, boom, 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 whatever. I would watch it to try to improve from a business aspect, and I would not watch the rest of the show. Afterwards, like when I got to TNA, I stopped even wanting to watch myself, so I watch a lot of other product.
Understandable. But you've mentioned a lot about, you know, when you left. You left summer of 2007 because you were part of WrestleMania 23 and the original New Blood match.
I wonder that. I've always wondered if it was 2006 or 2007, but you know that for a fact?
Well, I was there, man.
And that was 2007. Okay, good to know. Thank you, Nikki.
So now that, but with such a deal in place, have you thought about picking up your phone and seeing if Hunter would like to borrow you, say, for the MSG show in October or possibly for the next Rumble?
Well, it seems that runs are more where the mutual interest is with me, as opposed to single shows. I mean, I did do the Slammiversary, and you know, like years ago, I did like an appearance at Royal Rumble, mm-hmm. whatever. But it's like this: it'd be awesome to be at WrestleMania, but in order to be at WrestleMania, I'm gonna have to go to the Royal Rumble and then work January, February, March through April, and then those are the worst months to travel with all the snow and the canceled flights, and you got to pack all these extra clothes because it's so fucking cold outside and hot inside and everyone's sick. And anyway, having said that, it's not as easy as saying, hey, I feel like going to New York City, book me on the MSG show. It's more of, and plus, it has to mean something. When I came back in 2013, it was probably promoted with what I think might have been the biggest promotion of anybody's return. They kept showing videos, RVD's coming back. It was awesome. And they were showing footage of me from my earlier run, and they hadn't seen me in 6 years or whatever. So I was thinking, yeah, they're expecting the old RVD, and that's awesome because I know that's exactly what I'm going to give them. And I love that they just know that. Yeah, I'm not going to change. You know what I mean? I do my stretching, my conditioning, my workout. I'm consistent. When I go back, I'm still just going to be me. And anyway, it was a really good run. Had a lot of fun. 2014, I came back. I don't remember whose call it was, but I think it was mine. I think maybe they were in L.A. and I went and visited them. And I don't know. I can't remember how 2014 came about. But I think it was my idea, like, hey, let's do this. And they totally had nothing for me. Like, the writers weren't on board. I was basically fodder for the whole time that I was there. I didn't enjoy that as much. And to go back there to do that again would not be beneficial for me or for the business, I don't think, really. And so, you know, there has to be the right reason. Like, when I go back, it has to be when I'm going to be utilized and when I'm going to mean something. And they'll have to have big plans, which the last time, you know, there was no plans. Nobody knew what they were going to do with me. So they just, you know, I just was like filling a spot on the card, which, I mean, it diminishes the value of RVD, but at the same time, just being on TV, that also, you know, means a lot to your value from a different perspective. So there's that, but, what I'm saying is when I do go back, it will be for the right reasons, and, to just show up, there's no reason to do that.
I understand. Let me bring in my colleague here, Jim Williams. You said you had a question for Rob.
What
sure,
up, Jim?
Thank you, Rob, and thank you for doing this interview with us. Much appreciated. Big fan of yours. Me and Dad used to watch those matches you had with Jerry Lynn all the time on pay-per-view. They were legendary. Thanks right so much for all those memories. What I wanted to ask you is, you mentioned you're keeping up sort of kind of with what the industry is doing right now. A lot of people have been giving a lot of heat to Tough Enough, the current season of Tough Enough. I mean, when, for example, watching on the network when they were in Brooklyn for SummerSlam weekend, the Final Four got booed out of the Barclays Center, seemingly. You were around, of course, during the original Tough Enough back in the earlier part of the 2000s. What are your thoughts as a wrestler who's come up the hard way towards, you know, those who are trying to, shall we say, get in the front door, get a fast pass in the front door to WWE through Tough Enough? Do you think it still works? And with NXT being in place, is Tough Enough sort of kind of an obsolete idea, in your opinion?
I think that just about anything that Vince wants to make work will work. Because even if it doesn't work, he'll tell you it's working. It's been a long time that I've heard fans complain like, "Oh my God, they don't have any real superstars now on there." You know, there's like nobody that he doesn't see it that way. He's saying these are today's superstars, and he shoves them down your throat, and he draws big houses. I watch Tough Enough. It's actually my favorite wrestling show and the only one that I watch. I watched every episode, and I enjoy it because I like that part of the career being exposed. These guys are taking a backdoor in, for sure. Super shortcut. However, you know, that's the way that they get in. They have a lot of dues to pay. They should be getting their asses beat. You know, I like all of them kids that I saw in there. And I like Sarah, but it bothers the fuck out of me that she smiles too. Beat the shit out of her a few times and she won't be smiling. And that's the way that I got trained. The school that I went to with the original Sheik, there was a very, very small core group of four of us that were there every week working out. Other people would show up one time. If they stayed for a whole day, we would never see them again because it was so stiff. Sheik had us beating the shit out of each other. And, you know, that's old school. And so things are so different now. They change so much. It's like the old wrong is almost like the new right. And I don't even know how valid my understanding is sometimes, because my understanding might even be outdated, and that goes with why I don't watch wrestling, because it's not something I enjoy. I pick it apart in my head, and it's, you know, frustrating. But anyway, with the Tough Enough, even though they're taking the shortcut in, you still get to see the stages of these wrestlers that want to be wrestlers, that think they want this more than anything, and they got to show and prove that more than everybody. Hey, happy 420, East Coasters, by the way. But anyway, they have to. I mean, that when you come in like that, you have to eat, breathe, sleep it. You have to want it more than everybody else. You have to, you know, it's a sin to say that you don't love it more than anything else. That's the way I came in too. And I got no problem saying I love a lot of things more than wrestling. And that's been true for a long time for me. You know what I mean? Hey, I'm sorry if family comes first, but fuck, you know, like my priorities changed. But when I was 18, that was the set in order of my priorities. I wanted it so bad. I was going to give it everything I got. And it's really cool to see these guys at that stage going through self-doubt, you know what I mean, where they doubt their own choices in life and they think, wow, I thought like I had everything riding on black. What was I doing? I should have bet on red, because I remember that. I mean, I had that happen to me. Like, I remember bawling my eyes out. I should have went to college because some other wrestlers, Mark Starr and Jimmy Backlund, were like, you're never going to make it in this business. You fucking suck. You're not going to be a superstar. And I was like, oh my God, I should have listened to Dad. What was I thinking? But, you know, those guys are both dead, so fuck them.
Well, there you go. You talk about paying your dues. And that's something, again, going back to the Tough Enough angle, again, the fast pass, they pay their dues in an accelerated way, shall we say. Going back to when you were in your first run with WWE, do you remember those Tough Enough winners who got to the main roster and how they were treated backstage? Were they treated any differently? Were they, you know, dare I say, hazed or treated differently than the rest of the roster?
That's an excellent question. I don't really remember. It was like Melvin, not Melvin.
Maven.
You remember?
Maven.
Maven, yeah. Yeah, when I got to WWE, I think he was the guy that was from Tough Enough. And it was like everyone that I saw kind of seemed to have already accepted him by the point that I was there. And I don't recall after that who came up. I do remember the shooter, Daniel Pewter.
Yeah.
I think didn't he also come through Tough Enough?
He did. And he was from the same class that we eventually got Miz and Ryback.
Okay. Yeah. Well, shit. Okay. I didn't know Ryback was in that too. Well, it does seem like he didn't get, respected as much. Like they were trying to, it seemed like they were still trying to press him down, but he knew that he could fight and kick people's asses. And that's a balance. That's a balance you got to find, because there's a pecking order, there's respect, and you have to look up to certain people, and you have to, you can't come in disrespectful or you'll go right back out the door. But at the same time, you know, you have to learn to be humble and respectful. And it gets to a point that fans probably wouldn't even think about or be able to relate to. Like I remember when Bob Holly wanted to beat the shit out of Rene Dupree, and everybody knew it. Rene knew it. Everybody knew. It was a sellout at the curtain because we were all watching. And during the match, I mean, Bob was just beating the shit out of him. And Rene would be disrespectful if he fought back. So he's stuck in this weird position where he's got to kind of show respect and be professional, and at the same time try not to get a broken nose, because Bob was full out swinging, you know, left, right, left, just throwing these punches in him, because there was shoot heat there. And it's a weird position to be in, to a balance, you know. But hey, it's all about balance, right?
Exactly.
That's with everything in life. Absolutely. Absolutely. We got a few tweets, more than a few tweets, with the hashtag RVD on NAWC on social media. And I want to segue with one of those tweets back to the early days of the man that would become RVD, or the boy that would become the man that would become RVD. At Through the Ropes asks the following question. It's a good jumping off point. Who were your influences? Who were your influences in pro wrestling?
Well, yeah, I feel like I've answered this one like my whole career, but it's great to pay tribute to these guys that inspired me. First wrestler that I remember catching my attention and being my favorite was Leaping Lanny Poffo. He was a guy that would have been known as a jobber back in the days of the enhancement matches. Mm-hmm. And he caught my imagination, because there was all these big guys doing elbows and maybe like picking up a boot, and Lanny was the only one I saw doing back handsprings out of the corner, even, like, which is, became a moonsault. We didn't even know what that was, but flying head scissors. And he was exciting to watch for me, and he made me think outside of the box and try to imagine other acrobatic moves that I would want to see. And so that's what I always took as my foundation for entertaining other fans. And also in that same respect was Brady Boone, who wrestled also as Fire Cat. First guy I ever saw jump on someone's shoulders and roll him into a victory roll. And I was amazed. And Owen Hart, when he was the Blue Blazer, and he would drop down to his hamstrings on the top rope and do a backflip from there. These things inspired me, because I wasn't a 300-pound guy. And even if I was, maybe I would have still been turned on by seeing these high flyers that had original moves. The other guys' moves didn't seem to be original. I grew up on WWF. That was all that I was exposed to. And so it was, it was a really big guy sport back then. Uncle Elmer, Hillbilly Jim, King Kong Bundy, Kamala.
Larger-than-life figures, yeah.
All of them, yeah, they were huge. And so for me to see somebody, do a round-off into a flying head scissors or stuff, and I was like, whoa, that was cool. Then eventually, I liked, I started liking the heels. And so at one point, Hercules Hernandez was my favorite. Bret Hart was my favorite. And then the Ultimate Warrior hit me in a really big way. I got caught up in his intensity. And I saw him way before he was on TV, when he was doing the house show runs as the Dingo Warrior. And I was telling all my friends at school, you got to see this guy. He's awesome. Mm-hmm. And there you go.
Well, how and when were you first introduced to wrestling? Watching it on TV as a kid with the family, or going to a show, anything like that?
all my friends would watch it, and I did not. And I listened to the adults that didn't like it, you know, that said it was stupid. And so I was turned off from the idea. And one time, if I wanted to hang out with everybody, I had to go and watch wrestling because, you know, nobody else was out. Nobody else wanted to hang out. And I was probably, I think, 14-ish. I think it was around WrestleMania 2. It might have been WrestleMania. Which one were the midgets involved with the Bundy tag match?
Was that 2 or 3?
Three. I was at 3. I actually attended 3 live. 2 I actually saw on Close Circuit TV. So this was 1. So around WrestleMania, whatever year that was. So I was around that age. And wrestling had crossed over into my world because it was like there was a little footage of that midget, King Kong Bundy and the midgets. It was little people. Mm-hmm. Pardon me. Pardon me, midgets. No offense.
They'd laugh.
Vertically challenged people. There you go.
Yeah. I'm short. I'm used to it. Go on.
Yeah. So anyway, it was like on one of my mom's like morning shows, like Good Morning America or something. They talked about it. I saw that footage. I guess I was a little interested, and I went in with my friends to watch it one time. But I remember the conversations. I was like, God, the names are stupid. Big John Studd, Brutus Beefcake, and I would laugh, and I didn't know what I was talking about. But I watched it one time. And I was hooked because somehow Iron Sheik screwed over Corporal Kirshner, and I could not wait till the next week to see him get his revenge. I want justice.
Oh, so now that you've been on this long journey, I'm gonna dig into probably a couple of the really darker some of the bad stuff. From 06, 07, and I don't mean to bring the mood down.
Murdering someone dark, or
not that bad.
Oh, okay,
not that bad. I tell you that the fans in general thought that Vince was practically murdering the ECW name in late 2006, and I'll speak specifically of December to Dismember, or as we like to call it, December to Disaster.
Yes.
You were there. I unfortunately wasn't, but I was. It's my understanding from another fan that the show was so bad that Paulie was running around outside the chamber apologizing to fans.
Well, I don't know about that, you know, about Paul, but I mean, I felt the same way. I thought that was one of several times, but that I thought the ECW is finally done and dead. Like but that was the biggest. Like there was a few times I thought that, but that was for sure. Bringing Bobby Lashley forward as the representative of the new ECW, that was saying goodbye, good riddance, hardcore, extreme ECW, and all you fans that won't quit chanting, you know, that you want that shit. That was Vince saying, now it's a new product. I'm using the word ECW for my new show, and kicking it off with the momentum of, you know, what was left of the hot coals from the fire.
Because I know we were all shaking our heads. I watched it on pay-per-view. Yes, I was one of the unfortunate 98,000 people who put money down for this show. And I'm just sitting there, Extreme Elimination Chamber, and there's 5 weapons in there.
Yeah.
Dude?
It was stupid. I know when I got beat, like the fans turned their backs. a lot of the fans down at ringside turned their backs to represent, you know, their displeasure.
Well, they were already hot because Sabu was taken out ahead of time because he'd been taken out during the earlier in the program, and I think he was replaced with Bob Holly.
So I was hot too. You know, yeah. What I mean? I fought. Those decisions to bury the old ECW every step of the way until I knew there was no fight to have anymore. And then after that, I was checked out as far as my passion goes. Like I went through several cycles of frustration and passion, you know what I mean? When I was there, because right away that schedule, it'll burn you out, you know, unless you really love it and you got, and that's your real family and you love, you know, whatever, you know. But I'd already been wrestling over 10 years before I got there. So it was mostly just a lot of travel. It was cool. Big crowds. That's awesome. Wrestling in front of all those big, you know, packed arenas and seeing all the merchandise, you know, made and all that. I mean, I loved it, but the travel, the monotony, it gets old, you know. But when I got there, and I dreaded that. I didn't even want to go there because I thought I'd be selling out and I wouldn't enjoy it. But then when I got there in 2001, I was representing ECW. That was awesome. So I was motivated. We did that invasion angle, which I thought was really cool with the Alliance. It was a great idea, you know, historical as far as ECW, WCW versus WWF. Hell yeah. Then, you know, got burnt out, but then I got the hardcore title, so I'm having fun again, and then I get burnt out, and then, you know, that's how it always was. And when we brought back ECW, I was so happy and excited. And then week by week I saw, and it was cool. People forget, they just think that when it was brought back, the new version of ECW, a lot of people just, they think it just, in their mind, they think, oh, it was lame. But when it first came out, it was extreme. And I had some awesome matches with Bob Holly and with Sabu and with Test and with Kurt Angle and with many others on the Sci-Fi Channel. But then all of a sudden, you know, I'm seeing all the SmackDown and Raw wrestlers flooding into ECW, confusing, you know, the talent label, who's with who. And on top of that, they take away Extreme Rules. Now there's only one Extreme Rules match per show. And I was like, I mean, these were some of the only like lengthy conversations I had with Vince around this time. And I was like, Vince, you're destroying it because you're taking what makes ECW special and you're getting rid of it and you're making it just like the other products. And, you know, by adding rules, I mean, you're destroying Extreme Championship Wrestling. Like, it should be the violent league where other guys, if they have to come here, they come here to settle a score and it means something. And what he said to me, I couldn't deny. He said, Rob, I have to, my referees have to have credibility. I have to have rules so my referees have credibility. And I thought, well, who the hell am I to tell Vince McMahon what is better for a global brand, you know, that he's got his money in. So basically, I was waiting for my contract to expire after that.
Mm-hmm. Let me check here. Our dear engineer, I know, is still floating around out there. Carl, did you have a question for Rob?
And later on, probably.
All right.
Don't be shy, Carl. Don't
no, I'm
be
good.
Shy. Well then, let me bring this all the way back around. Then no, actually, there. I'll cheer you up. One Night Stand 2, the night you fought John Cena in the ballroom. I was there, and I certainly believed that if you had lost that match, there would have been nothing left of the ballroom. Was that translating?
Yeah, it was. I would say out of my whole career, that night was unique. In that respect, the fact that it felt like 100% for RVD and 100% against Cena. And it was so awesome because it wasn't just, obviously it wasn't just that match. It was what we both stood for. And that was my whole plight throughout my whole time with WWE was, you know, that's what I enjoy is being hardcore. I'm obviously a lot more durable than the other guys. I have more to show. That's where I excel. In fact, I think they got rid of the hardcore title because not everybody could keep up with me. They had to go tip over a taco stand or fight on the playground and jump in the kids' pit of balls or something. To me, I took that title. I had awesome 5-star matches and added extreme elements to it, like the chairs and the ladders and the guardrails. I've always understood that. And there's a lot of people that have imitated me. A whole generation of wrestlers that grew up watching me that were inspired by the things that stood out to them, but I never got to install any old school fundamental essential training in them. So like when I see all these today's wrestlers and they've told me individually that I was their favorite or that they watched me and they used to like whatever, I feel like they're all my bastard children because I didn't get to raise them. That's how I feel. But yeah, anyway, that was an awesome night, and I always stood for ECW and its style. It was the most fun artistically, for sure, that I had out of my career. So that's what that night meant. And that night, I also knew we were going to be bringing it back as a brand. So I was so excited, because I never would have been WWE champion had I not changed the entire playing field by suggesting to Vince that we bring ECW back. And when we did, RVD was the best to represent. And I changed everything and made my own path in my career. And I'm very proud of that. Later on, without passion, I couldn't do that. You know, I'm just there to show off every night. And really, that's all I enjoy about it anymore.
So, Jim, did you, okay. Jim's got to go, cause he has another engagement. I'm going to, I know you're not a tech savvy guy, Rob, but I got to post a picture that I've been meaning to give you for some time.
Pleasure talking with you, Rob, by the way. Fifth row Phillies game, enough said.
Right on, dude.
Later. Thanks.
Late.
Okay, let me see if I can get this in here.
Okay, by the way, while you're doing that, because I'm not tech savvy, as you know, I actually downloaded Skype so we could do this thing. But I'm doing something on stream.me, RVD at stream.me. And for a while, I'll be doing it Mondays at 4. And it's just it's like Periscope. You know, but you don't have to. It's free. You can get the mobile app. It's free. Or you go on the computer and go to stream.me and find me at The Real RVD. The people there, they give away prizes. So like if we get like 1,000 people in the room, then they're going to give away like gift certificates to WWE Shop Zone. And then we're just starting. We started last week. We didn't have 1,000 people, but we're working on it. We're going to be giving, I think I'm going to try to give away a prize at 420 if I can figure out how to do it. There's some random button that I'm supposed to push that selects a random viewer in the room, but then someone has to follow up on it. You know what I mean? So I got my eBay dude, and I think RVD's eBay is going to donate something at 420 if I can get that figured out in time for even this afternoon. But anyway, just starting out there, and I'm going to hang out there for a while, see if I can build something, because stream.me is pretty awesome, and I'm trying to learn. What made me think of it is you're going to post a picture. This is like a live chat, but it's also like a gaming website, and you can have all kinds of different windows in there and stuff. And I kind of want to make it like with guests that are Skyping, and I put their windows in, and I show videos like I did with RVD Live, but maybe we have some topics like RVD Radio, but it's its own thing. It's RVD at stream.me.
Awesome.
Boom.
So I have it uploaded in the Skype chat. What you're going to have to do, Rob,
I see it.
There's a little word balloon on the far right of the screen.
Okay, and I click on it.
And you should see some text. And if you scroll all the way down, there'll be a picture that I've been meaning to give you.
Got it. That's a very cool picture.
For our listening audience, this picture was taken at the ECW only house show in Huntington, West Virginia on July 2nd. And it's an awesome picture of Rob wearing both belts.
Yes. Two belts. I got the ECW heavyweight belt and the Spinner WWE Championship belt. And Justin Roberts is photobombing me, by the way. In the
corner. Would you rather have Justin Roberts photobombing you than Big Show, who you faced that night?
Oh, no. This was the night? No, this couldn't have been that night because I...
No, it wasn't that night. This was something else bad happened that night, but it wasn't you losing your belt.
Okay.
No, this was the night we had a whole bunch of mutants. We had a whole bunch of hardcore guys in the front row, and somebody, I don't know which one of these crazy idiots started it, but somebody started a Big Show's Got a Camel Toe chant that stopped the match dead.
Yes.
And both of you looked over our section, and we just started chanting, "Made you look, made you look, made you look."
Sounds like Philly.
Somehow we managed to do it in Huntington, West Virginia.
Oh, right.
I wonder if you'd rather hear that now than please retire.
I'm sure. I'm sure.
Is that what they're telling him now?
Yeah, that's the big chant that's going after the after
I don't
the big
think
show.
I'd be good as a heel for that reason. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much negative energy, but I mean, hopefully I'd do like they all do and understand that, you know, that reaction is good and that they're out there to get heat. But I just, you know, I love all the positive energy and love that I've always got from the fans. And, you know, I thrive on that. And I look for positive energy outside of the ring, too. So that's part of what I enjoy about it is just going out there. Mostly that's all I enjoy is that connecting with all of that energy and all those fans while I'm in the ring. You know, I've never been a fan of doing all the interviews and storylines and all that stuff. That's just kind of part of it. But positive energy, boom. And, you know, by the way, I realized recently, because I'm pretty good at studying life, I think. As you know, Nikki, you've always called me Zen Master.
Zen Meister.
Zen Meister, thank you. I forgot you were German. So I've recently realized, you know, because for my entire adult life, you know, I've gotten praise and cheers from like arenas like packed with people and stuff. I realized recently a lot of people, normal people, most people do not ever really experience that. So for them, it really means a lot if they have a lot of people, like for instance, I don't know, people singing happy birthday to them, especially if you're a kid, because then you've never even maybe even given a speech or even ever done something that some adults may have done. But I mean, I kind of like I lose perspective on certain things just because I do have a different life. And it really takes some analyzing to realize that, you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, attending those graduations and you know, wedding, stuff like that. It really means a lot. So, yeah. So anyway, not that it doesn't mean a lot for you know, celebrities also, but I'm just saying that it's a much bigger part of our life, having people excited to see you, giving you praise, cheering for you. It's a much bigger part of our life than it is for someone that only hears it when he, maybe if he hits a home run on the softball game, you know, and, you know, a couple times a month. But anyway, so I appreciate that. So cheers to you all.
Thank you. Let's see. I better see. Okay. Are you still, you're still tight. You're still tight with Uncle Paul, right? I mean, do you guys still at least catch up?
No, haven't had a reason to, but when I see him, we're going to hug each other, pretty long. And then I'll go to let go. And then I'll realize he's not letting go yet. And I'll be like, oh, okay. Yeah. I guess I'm the asshole to break away again. And he, you know, but we could let go, but he wants to be dramatic and let me know, you know, that he's happy to see me and that's cool. So I'll hug him too. And, okay. Now it's getting awkward. People are looking, we're okay. Anyway, I have a lot of friends like that I'm close to, even if I don't see them for 4 years, then bump into them in Germany.
There you go. Or bump into in a random concourse at the Target Center.
Yeah, there's a lot of people like that I still, you know, I consider family. And Paul, you know, he's on the grind and I'm not on the grind right now. And I'm kind of detached from that whole world. So like I kind of enjoy the isolated, disconnected, center focused vibration that I get when I'm out of sight, out of mind. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, but since you've been through this grind, you are a rare individual who has actually done WWF, WCW, ECW, and good, bad, TNA. Or indifferent, TNA.
Yeah, and by the way, a lot of people forget about this, but I consider All Japan Pro Wrestling up there with any of those because it was that big of a part of my career. In fact, I was there longer than I was with TNA, but it's in Japan, so a lot of people don't even know about it, or it's just, you know, not mentioned in my career. But from 93 to 97, that was my bread and butter. And then you know, afterwards I went back to Japan for different random companies over the years. Yeah. But go ahead. I'm sorry. Totally, I raked you and you were going to ask something really intelligent.
No, that's okay. I apologize that I forget a piece of your career because every part of it is important. It's just it. WWE has such a stranglehold on the wrestling perception in America that it's still even with Lucha Underground and New Japan with TV deals, it's hard to crack through.
Yeah, they're the standard setters, you know, because they are in all the households. Like, it's a shame to me, not a shame, but I kind of see like young, when I was in TNA, there was a lot of wrestlers that felt like they were as good as they needed to be. And I could tell that they weren't as well-rounded as most of the wrestlers I was used to working with because they hadn't been to the big show because they think that would be selling out or they didn't think they needed it or they felt like their life was decent. They're making a good enough living and enjoying what they're doing, whatever. But I feel like they owe it to their career, you know, to at least do a run up there if they have a chance because they are the standard setters. And like, if you think that you're a star and then you go to WWE, you find out, no, now you're a star. Now you have people in other countries that you've never even heard of that want to be you. Kids growing up wearing your t-shirts, you know, doing your poses, and it's a place that you're like, you'll never ever go to. You didn't even know existed. And they're like, what, 150 countries or some crazy? It's amazing, but they're all over the world. And you know, when people, you tell someone, you know, hey, what do you do? I'm a pro wrestler. They're going to say, what, like WWF, if they're old enough. Otherwise, you know, they'll say, you know, WWE. But they are wrestling because Vince says he is.
So, but the question that I was going to ask, and it's, this is pretty intricate because I want to get into your head on this part because you have worked for four major promotions and yes, TNA, at least for a little while, was a major promotion. I want to say compare and contrast them all, but we don't have all night.
Yeah, they're all very different.
So let me try to narrow it down a little bit. You had a brief time in WCW, and then you had your run in TNA. I recently read The Rise and Fall of WCW, and they did some comparing to TNA's product, not necessarily, you know, putting you under a bus. But how similar were they?
So there was a time when it was very similar in that when I was there because Vince Russo was the guy that was, I guess, writing the storylines. And there was, you know, when I got there, there was Kevin Nash and Scott Hall. And there was a lot of the talent, of course, Hogan. And X-Pac was there at first. But there was I heard that a lot, that it was similar to that. And what I noticed, it was run very much like an independent company that just happened to have TV. The house shows and even the TV for a big part of it is how I felt. I don't really know what WCW was like, though, except for firsthand experience speaking. December of 92 till about May of 93. I don't know why I remember my ins and outs with all the companies, but I guess because they were all very important steps of my career. And because of that, to go to WCW, I got to go way back down to the bottom step. And I was so green back then that it's a weird comparison. I was so green, you know, be on the road, at 22 years old, mm-hmm. 20, wait, in 92, I was, 21. Was I still 21 when I went there? Holy crap. And then in 93, I would turn 22. So, yeah, 21, 22. So I was just a kid and I couldn't really see behind, the curtain yet, so to speak. You know what I mean? I wasn't one of those kids. I mean, I wasn't one of those really advanced 21-year-olds, you know, that's already been driving and partying and smoking cigarettes since I'm 14 and has two babies. And I wasn't like that at all.
Right.
I grew up very much in a Leave It to Beaver like household, you know, and I just left the nest, so to speak.
Right.
So it's hard to compare that to TNA, where I've already been, at the top for a long time and could look at it and see mistakes and offer help and see the help get shut down and then hear rumors about espionage from the inner office and then study and then start to believe it and then form my opinion. And then in the meantime, I spent most of the time in TNA. And by most of the time, I think if you ask any other talent that I was there to compare, I would say 96% of my 3-year deal with TNA in my car, in a parking lot, not traveling, just in the parking lot. I just hung out there as opposed to the dressing rooms, and not for any other reason other than I was just comfortable out there. And when I went in, it was like going to work. And if you can work 2 hours a day instead of 6 hours a day, then you know a lot of people would. And that's kind of how it was. I would sit in the car and listen to Howard Stern on satellite radio usually, and then go in when it's time to stretch. And then go back out to the car, and then I'd go back in right before my match and shower, go back out to my car, and drive on to the hotel. And it wasn't for any bad reasons. That's just my what do you call it? My mojo, my moto, my whatever, my method of random. What is it? My more.
Your method of madness.
There
but
you go.
I have a hard time using that in your case.
That's just how I maintain the way I see it for me anyway, for a long, long time. If there's like a goal to living life every day, you know, from a spiritual perspective, which is a big part of where my decisions come from, a huge part, I would say if there's a goal of every day is to try to maintain Zen, try to maintain as peaceful of a vibration even when you're confronted with obstacles like that for me. So whatever I can do to avoid, I avoid confrontation, I avoid stress even more. And that's what makes me, you know, maybe that's part of why people say, hey, you're not, you know, hey, you make a deal with Father Time, you're not aging, or hey, how come you're healthy? How come you're happy? It's because that's what I try to do. Sometimes it takes laughing in the face of potential stress when other people are getting worked out and you're trying to not take on their vibration. Other times it might take, lining yourself up with things that you know affect you in a positive way throughout the day, you know, and seeking love. Love lifts you up there, and love's all about positive energy. So that's mostly what I do. And if I'm sitting in the building, in the locker room for 4 hours, I'm probably going to be pretty bummed out. I mean, guys are playing video games together, whatever, you know, or throwing a football, whatever. I'm not into that. You know what I mean? I would rather enjoy being outside talking on my cell phone, probably calling home or taking care of my own business or something. So that's just how I do. You know what I mean? Like I punch in when I have to, and then I punch out as soon as I can.
There you go. And that's what a lot of us are doing anymore. I know I have some of my own stresses in my life, which I won't go into.
Everybody does.
Yeah. So I'm working on that. But you know, running into you every now and again, that helps me.
Awesome.
So, God, what was I? Well, actually, okay. No, I don't think I want to even ask you that. Now, speaking of lighting things up, sir, you are an advocate. You are a grand advocate of marijuana legislation, and you and I had wonderful conversations when you were running your podcast back in the late 2000s. You're not quite as vocal or militant as, say, Sean Morley, but you have your stance.
True. Are you just giving me a platform?
Yeah,
I guess you are. So okay. So we have our different stances, as you say. Mine is from an educated point of view. Cannabis and cannabis prohibition are among some of the very few hobbies or things that I'm passionate about in life. You know what I mean? There's just some that I'm passionate about. So when I talk about it, it's fascinating to me to tell people about stuff that they don't know when it's stuff that I find like very interesting. And I find the more that you learn about marijuana prohibition, the more you learn about how our world really works, how our government works. Mm-hmm. When you find out that it was really prohibited all on lies, and you find out that marijuana was made illegal because of all the money that can be made by the big business tyrants, and that's why it's illegal, then you can understand why it remains prohibited. Because a lot of people, they're seeing all the movements right now, and they're saying, Rob, when are they going to realize how much money we can make off of taxing marijuana? As soon as they realize that, it's going to be legal everywhere. You've probably heard that. It's a very common perception that I hear from people. The response to that is, there'll be some money made from taxes, but who's going to lose money? Everybody that keeps it prohibited, which is alcohol, tobacco. It can replace up to 80% of pharmaceuticals, fuel, believe it or not. Prison systems. Oh my God. You think you can just like make a crime not a crime and just stop arresting people for something when the majority of the people that are arrested are for that in certain places for simple possession of marijuana? I mean, the prison systems, they're going to be hurting so bad. So all of these companies, plus many, many more companies that don't want hemp to be utilized, because you can make over 20,000 products from hemp. And Henry Ford made a car out of hemp, and it ran on hemp seed oil, and he introduced it to the World Fair like in 1941. And if you're interested, you should Google that. Google Henry Ford hemp car, and you'll see a picture of him hitting it with an axe. And it's like, I think it's like half the weight of a normal car, but three times as strong. I could have those numbers wrong, but it's close to that, and it's amazing. But they decided to go with, nylon just got a patent on plastic, and, the earth wasn't, the earth's future wasn't in anyone's interest in any of those categories that I gave you: fuel, pharmaceuticals, alcohol, tobacco, prison systems. And then if you want to get into the lumber, I mean, William Randolph Hearst, who ran the newspapers, helped push it out of the legal system by publishing all these crazy articles in his paper that he made from the trees that grew for 20 years, not annual trees like hemp that you get a full crop every year. Anyway, the agenda was profit, and all these businesses will lose money when marijuana is completely legalized. And so that's what a lot of people don't realize is the big picture. These businesses have tremendous money, and they're the ones that fund all the silly propaganda videos. But now, because it's legal in 23 states medicinally, and because we have four states right now that have it recreational, plus the District of Columbia in both categories, and we're getting several more in the next year of both categories, and the next year after that, by 2017, I think the federal position very well should be changed by by 2018. I've been telling people 5 years just to be generous and be on the more conservative side, but I expect it to change before that. Because here's the thing: I just want to state two facts, because I could talk about this for hours. Let me just give you a quick schooling of marijuana in two quick facts. Okay, fact number one, It is absolutely impossible to overdose from it fatally. It does not have the toxic levels that would cause death. You would have to consume a third of your body weight at one sitting in order to reach levels that might possibly cause death. So there's absolutely zero cases in the history of the planet. People will tell you that it's happened, but you can't get the name. I've put out, and I'll put this on here too. I put this out for a while because doctors, their rhetoric is, oh yeah, people have died. They've gotten cancer from smoking marijuana. I know I was going to make it a simple fact, but I just want to back it up in case anyone's interested. So the doctors, the rhetoric that they give is like, yes, lung cancer has been associated with smoking marijuana. The fact is you cannot get one name of somebody that legitimately has this case. And I talked to a doctor. I'm not saying it was a WWE doctor, but I'm not saying it ain't, because I saw this claim on a failed test. So I asked him, well, I don't have access to this information, doc. Is there any way you could provide me with one name of anybody? It'd be great, of someone that died from lung cancer because of smoking marijuana. He said, well, what they did was, you know, they looked at corpses that had died from the cancer, and then they found that they had marijuana in their system. I said, well, okay, well, then obviously they separated those from the corpses that had smoked cigarettes and marijuana, and then separated those from the corpses that had just smoked cigarettes, and compared all of those, right, to have an honest comparison. Well, I don't know if anybody did that. What? How can you say there was any kind of honest conclusion to the test then? I totally don't get that. Anyway, cigarettes kill 50% of long-term users. One out of two people that smoke cigarettes long-term will die statistically. Zero in the history of the planet for smoking marijuana. I'm not saying nobody smoked and then fell off a balcony or ran out in a car or anything stupid like that. The other fact is that you should know is the federal position, and this is why people get arrested, get their property seized and sold, get their dogs shot, if not killed themselves. The federal position is that marijuana is completely non-medicinal. 23 states and the District of Columbia, and a city in Maine, by the way, Portland, Maine, disagree because they have a medical marijuana programs. However, since Richard Nixon put the Controlled Substance Act together in 1970, marijuana has been a Schedule I controlled substance, along with heroin and acid, as the worst and most dangerous drugs with zero medicinal value. Schedule II, meaning higher in medicinal value and safer for you and for the environment, that's where you find cocaine and meth. That needs to change, but again, Google it, look it up. This is the way that it is. The federal guidelines tell you cocaine and meth are safer for you and better for you than marijuana, because marijuana is still the most dangerous drug since 1970. Here we are in 2015, and we know it's got medicinal value. Now that it's getting legalized in certain places, although the feds still can override every single state, now they're doing some honest studies and they're finding, whoa, there's not just THC in marijuana. It's only one out of over 90 properties. Guess what? They got CBDs, which are totally medicinal and non-psychoactive at all. Kids are getting cured from uncurable shit like seizures, chronic seizures from the CBDs. Not getting high, nothing wrong with it. But you know what? The pharmaceuticals don't want you to know about that.
Of course not. They don't want to lose money. And as somebody who occasionally has to deal with big pharma, yeah. So, but like I said, and as I said, I really think this whole thing has to be settled at the federal level, just on your last point. The fact that the federal government can still override a state law, and if it was done from there, we'd probably already be set.
And by the way, I was told that when we reach 38 states, not half like you would think, but 38 states, that that vote it through and have medicinal programs, then the federal government is mandated to make a change. And this was precedented by, wait for it.
Wait for it.
Sodomy.
You gotta love the world sometimes, but no, that I understood a two-thirds majority, and it's hard, and 38, I believe, is roughly 50/50. I don't math very well on my days off.
Yeah, I could be off by one, but I think it's 38. I think when we get 37, we're all gonna be going, "Come on, North Dakota!"
I'm surprised. Given how much it's booming in the Dakotas, they, you know, that would just be another perk for them to move out there.
But you know what? I mean, everywhere, like, people thought that it would never happen in Texas and in Florida, and they have programs that they're trying to get through there. And it doesn't surprise me, because the information is getting out there, mm-hmm. and people are realizing that the information that they use as guidelines is outdated.
Yep. And I have a friend in Colorado who speaks highly of it now that they've got it set. Now that it's, I believe, is it just medicinal in Colorado, or is it recreational?
No, it's recreational. Colorado was the first state to implement the recreational weed. They voted it through the same day as Washington, but they were ready for it. They had shops ready to go. They'd already had all their medicinal shops and systems in place, ready to switch over. And so everyone boomed to Colorado, and a lot of people think, you know, that they're the only place to go, but they are way ahead of everybody else in the country. So in April, on 420, when they have the Cannabis Cup in Denver, Colorado, it is the number one place in the entire world to go to for that kind of a event. And I can tell you, it's so, so fucking big.
I believe it. I certainly believe that. I have my stance, and maybe my information is incorrect, but I guess just at the end of the day, I don't want smoke in my lungs.
No, that's fine. That's the thing, is I would never tell somebody that I feel like they should do it themselves. You know what I mean? I mean, maybe I would tell somebody if I really thought it would help them. I'd say, I don't know, maybe you could try it. But I mean, I don't, first off, you know, I don't think that I really, unless somebody cares to hear it, then I don't really want to like push the information onto anybody, you know. But anyway, in response to what you said, you know what? It's like a magic smoke. Have you ever heard of medicinal smoke before? It's crazy. And the fact that there isn't any lung cancer cases associated with it, or throat cancer or tongue cancer, is worth saying, wait a second, you know why? I had Mark Emery, the Prince of Pot, who's a very famous Canadian exporter that was facing extradition charges. Anyway, he told me that most people throughout the day, unless they're swimmers, they never have a reason to take a really deep breath in, like really inhale and stretch their lungs out. Most people just don't ever do that. He says, tokers, you know, they go and they breathe in like really deep. And he said, because of that, he said that the THC gets into deeper pockets of your alveoli and it scoops out impurities and helps cleanse it up. I don't know for sure that that's true, but that was told to me like way back in 2001. And it stayed in my brain as like, yeah, maybe.
And there you go. Yeah. No, I knew I wanted to bring that up at least briefly on the podcast, because that is one of your big passions, whether the state you're in agrees with you or not.
Quick story.
Yeah.
Quick story. And by the way, of course, you can eat it, you can vaporize it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to smoke it, of course. But quick story, because I don't know how anybody could not care about this. If you do know what I know, and you know that it can help people. Okay, so my wife was going through cancer treatments, right?
Yes, I remember this.
Okay, City of Hope, one of the biggest research cancer treatment centers in the country. in California. Okay, so we're at this nutrition meeting with this dietitian. She's on stage. It's not just a, it's a, you know, a big room of a whole bunch of patients, and she's giving advice about shit. And this old lady raises her hand, and she says, what can I do to put on weight? She says, I've got no appetite. I'm just so weak and tired, and then whatever I eat, I just throw up anyway. And the lady says, you know what, honey, just keep trying. Just keep trying. There's little, I know it's hard, but there's like little tricks you can do. Like if you sprinkle evaporated milk, you know, on your food, it'll give you some more calories. And I'm like, wait a second. I raised my hand. I said, what about medical marijuana? And she says, okay. She says, thank you. Since you brought it up, yes, I'm not allowed to bring it up myself, but since you brought it up, and then she proceeds to tell this class of dying people, a lot of people have gotten good benefits from marijuana. It's helped them with their appetite, with uncomfortableness, with nausea. It's helped them sleep, you know, and it's helped them just deal with life overall. I'm like, wait, this is California. It's been medically okay since 1996. And here it is, one of the biggest research centers in California, where a fucking marijuana dispensary could be across the street. And your policy is you're not allowed to tell these suffering, dying people. I think that's bullshit. How could anybody not care?
No, I'm with you. I'm with you on that. I'm just, like I said, I need to do a little bit of my own research.
Well, whatever. I don't expect anyone to be as passionate about me about it, but I can talk about mobster history and be pretty passionate too.
There you go. Carl, are you still with us?
Did we lose Carl? All right, yeah. We've been on for an hour 14, huh?
Well, I'm pretty sure he's still here. So let me, if he's not, then we might be running out of recording space. I do need you to stick around, though.
Right.
Let me know when you're back, Muckamuck. So let me, what else did I have on my list here?
Anybody that wants to learn more, I suggest, I recommend MPP.org. That's marijuanapolicyproject.org. They're my favorite advocacy group. There's like three big ones. There's also NORMAL, and then there's America's for Safe Access, and they're all good. MPP is one that I'm involved with, and they change laws state by state. People don't realize how many changes there are, like almost every week, in little cities or states, or even the smallest little changes. Like some states, even after they approve it medically, then they block the access from ever getting to the patients. It's like, well, why even fucking bother then? And there's all, every state is different, and people don't realize what it takes to make just the littlest changes, and trying to be more progressive is how I like to put it, because it's a backwards way of thinking, wanting to block people from getting this and making it regulated and taking it off the streets.
And there you go.
Okay. What else?
Okay. Since we brought that up in the multi-state thing, I almost don't want to ask you about this, but it kind of relates back to the picture.
I don't think the government should have the right to govern your butthole. I think that should be up to you.
Okay. Then that might save me a question. Okay, seriously. Why should I be serious? Let me put out a thought. I'm going to bring it back around to wrestling. Since you've worked on and off with Hunter when he was a wrestler, and now as the evil boss, Dr. Levesque, I mean the COO of WWE. Where was I going with this? Wait a minute. Excuse me. He's awake. Okay. Since Hunter is one of the big backers behind NXT, which is WWE's developmental league, and pretty much put itself in the top five of wrestling leagues in the country, or at least by perception, could this have been what ECW was trying to do in the late 90s, early 2000s, if they had had the budget?
I don't think so. I mean, it could have been a talent? No, I don't think so. One, I mean, Paul was losing talent, you know, left and right to WWE or WCW, you know, to bigger contracts than he was able to afford. But that wasn't something he ever wanted. He wanted people to stay long term so he could invest in them. And that's what the fans wanted, too. They mostly got behind the originals, you know, like Sandman, guys that had been there since the beginning, and the style is so different. You know what I mean? Like, to start out in ECW and have your head busted open with a chair every night, and be fighting like through the crowd, and then you know, and have those and have those fans, I don't know what, body surf you or hand you weapons, or, you know, to go through that kind of emotional up and down through a match in that environment. And then if that was like the regular path for people to go from there and then to go to WWE and back in the day, you know, do what was, you know, like an arm bar and lay on the mat, you know, I think that would drive most people insane.
Fair enough. So, okay, now we have Carl back. Carl, you had some insights you wanted to talk to Rob about.
Any good Sabu stories?
I'm sure I have hundreds of Sabu stories. I got to think if any are appropriate. You know? Sabu. So Sabu is like the only guy in the business, you know, that I felt, you know, was like really my brother, like family. Like I guess I'm not that social of a person. I'm much more of a loner. I don't know if I've always been like that. Definitely as an adult, you know, when I got to really look at myself from that perspective. But Sabu is someone that, you know, wherever in the world I am, if he's there, we're going to try and get together. You know, I'm going to, you know, take care of him if he needs me to. He's got my back. I've got his back. And we had that. No, I never had that with anybody else, like in and out of the ring like that. I mean, Booker T and I were really cool. We rode together and definitely had a different, really cool relationship that could be similar out of the ring, but we just didn't go through the stuff that Sabu and I had, you know, like in Japan, like the style was like so competitive. Sabu and I were tagging against, let's see, Akiyama and I think Amori. And they were just like, it was so competitive that we would strategize like you would a football game or something. Sabu and I would get together and we'd say, look, let's try and blow them up, which means, you know, get them really winded. And so we would, we'd say, let's get one of those guys and try and separate the ring and try and keep them in our corner. And every time he tries to go back to his corner for a tag, you know, like if you're outside and you see him going for a tag through the corner, you know, come in and grab him, grab his foot, pull him in or whatever. Let's do a bunch of quick tags and stuff so we can rest and be fresh and tire the guy out. And it was really competitive. And people don't realize, like, they try and throw out the whole competition thing when it comes to wrestling, but you want to be the one that's getting the attention, the one that's making the money, the bigger star. You got to do that at the expense of the other ones, but also you know, with help from them and everything that's around you. But that's something that people can't understand and don't want to understand. They just want to think that everybody's playing and that it looks fun. I can pull up into a diner on the road and someone go, hey, your buddy was just here. He doesn't know if the person's my buddy, but just because we're wrestlers and we play together in the ring, you know what I mean? So anyway, that's a perspective that outsiders, fans, regular people have that I could clear up. The competition in Japan was crazy just like that because they were trying to do the same thing to us. They were trying to tire us out, keep us in their corner, and try to keep switching on us. And they wanted to get ahead. We both wanted the shot at the tag team title coming up. And I mean, it sounds like I'm doing an interview in character, but I'm not. We were really competing during the match. You know, regardless of the finish, we were going to try to outshine, outwork, and make the other guys look bad, because that's exactly what they were doing to us every night. So Sabu and I had that everywhere, all over the world. We were in Mexico at a strip club one time, ready to fight like about 8 bouncers, and man, Sabu, we're back to back, and he was hopping up and down, and I was like, calm down, Sabu, I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to talk our way out of this. And that's a story I've never shared. Yeah.
So, did it bother you? Well, no, I'm going to skip that question. I was going to say, did it bother you when Sabu left the Fed before you did?
Yeah, it did, of course. I really liked having him there, but I knew he was miserable. He hated it, and I was trying to talk him out of quitting every week, so it wasn't like a big surprise, but he left, got himself fired. He went and did something really stupid on purpose, then went to the office and told on himself because he didn't want to be there anymore. And, I mean, when somebody doesn't want to be there, you know, I mean, all I could do is feel like he's making a mistake, but it's his mistake to make.
Right. Because, I mean, you know, like I said, the late 2006 through early mid 2007 was a really, really hard time for ECW in general, even though the original doors had been shuttered for 5 years, and they had tried, Vince was trying to remake it in his image and try to do all this crazy crap by inserting his own superstars into a product that we already know. We apparently seem that fans feel like they know more about than he does. Where he committed one of the bigger sins and actually started strutting around with your belt, sir.
Yeah, I hated it.
I think that's the closest I've ever seen you to being angry.
Yeah, I don't remember what all was caught on camera, but I. During that time, but I remember my feelings at that time were, okay, this is why he brought ECW back, just so that he could make himself king and own something that he had no control of before. Because I think it bothered him a little before that people would chant ECW and he didn't get credit for it because it wasn't something he did at all of his shows and stuff. And you might have heard me say this before, Nikki, but hold on a second. I'm trying to think about at what point in time this was. I'm losing what I was going to say, but
I just remember that you and Tommy and Sandman, and I think Sabu was interviewed, and Sandman just cussed up a storm. Tommy couldn't really put it into words, but I know it hurt.
Yeah, I think Sabu threw a chair down.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, so the reason that I thought at that point was he brought it back and wanted to make himself king and own it and then just bury it. When I was telling him that he needed to, at some point I was selling ECW to him. It must have been when it was going downhill, when I was saying, you know, I can't remember. I think it was at that conversation when I was telling him, you know, that he's just destroying what makes it different or whatever. I said to him, those fans, you know, they, because he said, Rob, nobody cares about the old ECW. That's what it was. And nobody remembers that anymore. And not that many people saw it. And I said, Vince, why do you think the people chant ECW everywhere? He goes, because I taught them to do that.
Oh, my God. He's more delusional than I thought.
Thank you. And so when he brought it back and he had the belt on, I was like, okay, he brought it back, you know, to own it, to bury it. And I thought, you know, he's got the money and the power to do that. I think, you know, he did the same thing with the football and with the bodybuilding. And,
oh, yeah.
He can do it with the movies, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And you only got one of those right, by the way.
He doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't matter. He's got the money to gamble, you know, and I guess. I don't know.
No, I get it. I'm, you know, I probably shouldn't hit such dark times. And unfortunately, they're gonna start chanting ECW a bit again now that the Dudleys are active in WWE. They just showed up on TV a couple of weeks ago.
But you see, now he can take credit for that.
That he can take credit for. He will use all of his Attitude Era back footage with them and the Hardys and Edge and Christian. He might not, you know, he might pull out snippets from the ECW library now that he owns it.
Yeah, maybe.
So.
That's Vince McMahon.
No, I'm not. I shouldn't be surprised. So with that, compare him to Dixie.
Oh my God! So Dixie was very motherly. I couldn't help but invest my feelings. You know, like I cared about her. I loved her. I thought she was a really nice lady that I enjoyed being around, and I wanted to see her succeed. So I felt like, you know, anything I could do to help the company grow, then I felt like, you know, I should. And I didn't feel like there was others there. I felt like a lot of efforts, you know, were deliberately, for whatever reason, kiboshed, that could have helped with brand recognition or other areas just to help it grow, because it wasn't that, it didn't have that much exposure. Usually when I would be in town somewhere, in some town at the gym, the people at the gym would have no idea why I was there. RVD, what are you doing in town? You know what I mean? And I was definitely a bigger star than the brand. And I was trying to, you know, do what I could, you know, products, stuff that they could do to get it out there. Just, besides the efforts, they would draw 900 to maybe 1,100 people every house show, but pretty consistently, like the whole 300, I mean, the whole 3 years that I was there, and they seemed happy with it. Like they didn't really seem to want to grow. So I didn't really understand it, but I didn't want to see Dixie fail. And I still don't, you know. I would help her if there was a way I could. I just, you know what I mean? But I don't know. I mean, I don't even know if she needs help, you know. Who knows what she's doing? She seems to be able to keep going as long as she wants to, and hopefully she's having fun. But I felt like she delegated and trusted some questionable people to be on her team to help her move forward. And so, you know, again, that's her mistake to make.
Exactly.
Oh, so anyway, with Vince, he's always been super cool and respectful to me. He's never been anything but respectful, but he's Vince McMahon. I mean, he's intimidating, I think. You know what I mean? He's like, he's when he's in the room, at least I do. I've never had that hang out and have a drink and bullshit and bond with him. And I was told by some pretty credible people that kept me from going up another rung on the ladder. Just that I didn't have that connection with them. But, you know, just, I'm just real, dude. Whatever.
Carl, did you want to talk to him about, you two have actually run into each other.
That was a house show in 2012 for TNA. You were in the main event, I think it was Rude you faced, had a good match.
And of course I had a good match.
And then you had the photo op after in the ring. And one of the guys kept messing up with my camera. We had to do it twice.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that was some of the guys. Like, Booker wouldn't do that, you know. And his argument was that brings the superstar level down. You know, that's one of the things that I was talking about where I said TNA was run a lot like an independent company, like an indie show. You know, like you book some indie wrestlers, try to draw people, and you're only doing a show, I don't know, twice a year or something like that. And you try and get them to do, you know, the autograph appearances, you know, and the win a dinner with your favorite wrestler afterwards, sponsored by the local pizza place, whatever. But that's with TNA every single night on the house shows. There's somebody, if not me, then, you know, they'd rotate someone else and it'd be in the ring, and everybody can, you know, come in, they pay, and then it's extra money. But, you know, then they come up and have a photo with you. I mean, can you imagine if, like, at every WWE show you get in the ring with The Undertaker and he's gonna, you know, like a puppet, go, dude, put your arms around my neck like you're choking me, bro. You know, I don't know. I can't see that just because that one is on a bigger level.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, we have a panelist who...
Yeah, we have a mutual friend who did that.
Well, he ran into Undertaker at a Waffle House after a house show and was scared to death because of that barrier, that level that you're talking about.
Yeah, you lose that. Maybe you lose that when you make Sabu talk, too, by the way. It's that same kind of thing. You lose something.
One thing I did enjoy about TNA was the fact that there was that accessibility. At one time, yes, I had a chance to at least shake hands with the majority of the TNA roster.
Yeah.
But I, you know, you look at a WWE roster and like there's still 50 people I haven't even had a chance to, you know, at least wave at.
Right. Well, yeah, and I'm not complaining, and I never had a problem with it. I enjoyed meeting the fans, but I'm just explaining, you know, the other perspective, like from business end, and like a fan could say, yeah, TNA is cooler because I got to meet the wrestlers. WWE, you don't. Okay, but TNA drew 900, WWE drew 9,000. So which one is better for business? Having celebrities that are larger than life that you see on TV, but now you get to actually see them in person in the ring from across the bleachers, or the other one where you can go like, hey, Rob, remember me? I got your photo 4 times. Yeah. Oh, hey, what's up, Steve? You all right?
So, no, it's just an observation. And
Mine too.
And WWE is semi cashing in on that by doing private meet and greets and VIP programs. I'm just, who would pay $300? Because apparently there are people that will pay $300 to go to one of the house shows where they're only going to draw 3,000 or 4,000 people, but they're going to get to meet this guy.
And don't forget various cons around the country too.
Well, the convention circuit's a little bit different. What I'm talking about that WWE apparently has realized that they can lower the wall just a little bit and take a pretty good chunk of your money. They're utilizing that wall. It's not a complaint.
That sounds like better business than giving it away for $10 every single night. Then it's special. And, you know, to some people, their $300 is like your $30. And you got to remember, the correct value of anything is exactly what someone else is willing to pay for it.
So I personally would not pay $300 to go to an event where I'm just going to meet that guy.
What if you were a millionaire?
If I was a millionaire, I'd go to Wrestle. I would probably put all that money down and go to WrestleMania and do it there for the full experience.
And then your ticket costs more than $300.
Well, yeah, but I also get, not only do I get the show, but I get the chair, I get all the swag, I get to meet more than one wrestler, and I can take a whole week off without worrying about my bills.
Okay. Yep. Everybody's got their own value system and the right to have that. So that's awesome. I never try to rub my values off on anybody else, and I expect but don't receive the same treatment.
Well, Rob, I really appreciate you putting up with us. We have just we have only recently passed the 4:20 mark in Central Time.
Cool. Right on. Yeah, enjoyed it. You sound like crystal clear on my end. I'm surprised. And I'm getting ready to do that stream.me show in an hour and a half myself. So I'm going to set up for that. And robvandam.com is the place to go. That is my hub where you get all my social media and everything is there. And the stream.me link is also in the bio on all my Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all that. I might have to still put it on my YouTube. No, I think I did that. Anyway, yeah.
So Rob Van Dam, ladies and gentlemen, again, thank you for your time. Thank you for the insights, and thank you for the perspective, because everybody needs a little perspective.
Thank you, Rob.
Right on, man. Enjoyed it, Nikki. I appreciate seeing you on the way to all of those shows for so long, dressed like the man with the suit and the hat, Paul Heyman. And so that's why I said, hell yeah, I'll do your show. Good luck with it.
Thank you so much. We've been doing very well. Thank you for having me on your show in the past. And thank you for helping me enjoy wrestling from very, very, very different perspectives, from many different perspectives.
Cool, cool. Be healthy. Be well, guys.
Have thank a great you.
Day. Happy Labor Day. I don't know when you're posting this, but
later on the night.
Okay, cool. All right, cool. Peace.
Peace.